Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Back in the USSR, I am Siegfried, and welcome to the new era, my friends. Serious quotes on new era, of course. Trump is gone. The adults are back in the room. Sanity has won through, and everything is good. Right? Well, no. There are plenty of powerful interests that want you to believe that right now, and the PR blitz is nothing short of breathtaking, like in the last week or so. Last week, in my first show of the new year, I went into details of about the present situation and the literal catastrophe that capitalism has unleashed on America and many other countries, that all of which fundamentally failed to come to grips with the pandemic. And the reason is because these countries, Canada included, placed profits before people and continue to do so. This fundamental fact isn't going to change, regardless of how many times Biden repeats that he is going to act according to the science. Let's unpack that for a moment. Biden made a lot of promises in his, the first few days he was in office and signed all these executive orders, and we're going to go through a bunch of those. Let's unpack that for a moment. Biden One of the things he promised was to vaccinate 100 million people by the end of his first 100 days in office. You know, 100 million in 100 days. And no doubt that's some pretty impressive rhetoric after all the nonsense Trump was spewing over the course of the last year. You know, remember at first, like, he pretended the pandemic wasn't even a problem. No measures needed to be taken. It was just a, you know, fundamentally a Chinese problem, like, originally. They didn't think it was even going to affect, like, Western countries. And they had all the racist stuff they were spewing about China even before, like, the pandemic even started affecting the U.S. And they started, like, you know, amping that up even more. But, you know, Biden's rhetoric is equally nonsensical. You know, about the 100 million, vaccinating 100 million people in 100 days. Equally nonsensical. I mean, the United States doesn't have a functioning healthcare system right now. There is no mass testing, no targeted quarantines, no effective effort to stop the virus at its source, no shutting down of non-essential workplaces, no adequate income support for workers, and no debt relief. And remember that last point. Beyond a slight expansion of the food stamp program and an extension of the repayment of student loans, there might, and I stress might, be a $1,400 federal check for each person, for each American citizen, rolling out sometime in the first half of 2021. If Biden's stimulus bill is passed unaltered, which is unlikely given that he's committed himself to working with the Republicans and Wall Street Democrats, of which he is one. Let's be clear on that. You know, in this, you know, he's not a Bernie Sanders kind of guy. Let's just say that, right? Like, in fact, he's the exact opposite, and we'll get into that a little later. I mean, in this environment, even if 100 million vaccines could be distributed to the public, which, once again, seems to be administratively impossible given the state of American healthcare, it wouldn't stop the pandemic. For it to end the pandemic, the virus would have already had to be contained, you know, before the vaccination campaign even began. I mean, China is in a position to do this. Cuba is in a position to do this. Maybe some European countries are in a position to do this, but America is not. And neither is Canada. Vaccination is only the last step of containing the virus, not the first. It's not a magic bullet. Vaccines are not a magic bullet. You can't just, like, spread this around and hope, like, you know, have the virus stop in its tracks. You know, you have to contain it first. Vaccination happens afterwards, after you deal with it. Then you make sure it doesn't come back. That's the vaccination part. And yet here they basically got everything backwards. I mean, Biden's health strategy is basically too little too late. And the same could be said for virtually every single one of the 15 executive orders that he signed on his first day in office. You know, he had that whole news session where he had, like, this big pile of, like, you know, executive orders on his desk, and he was going through them and signing them one after the other and basically talking about how important this was and how game-changing this was and all that. And, of course, you know, we've already had people who have been hailing this as some great progressive victory because he signed all those executive orders on his first day in office and, like, you know, and they're saying how impressive this is, and, like, they're thanking him on social media and all this sort of stuff. They're just gushing over it. And as I mentioned earlier, let's just, like, kind of once again unpack this stuff. As I mentioned earlier, he extended the already existing freeze on student loan repayments until September. You know, he extended this. I think it was set to expire at the end of this month. He extended it till September. It's important to remember this is not debt relief. It's just delaying the inevitable, you know, and preventing a certain amount of interest to accrue, which, I mean, that's good, but nonetheless, it's not debt relief. Debt relief would be canceling the debt, which there's no indication he's going to do anything like that. And the same goes for his extending the moratorium on evictions until March. I mean, rent and student debt are both deep points of crisis in America right now. They amount to trillions of dollars. You know, debt, back payments, all this sort of stuff, right? And neither of these executive orders concerning either of these subjects will do anything to solve these problems, which afflicts so many working class and oppressed people, you know, across America. And the fact that one of the laws that Biden actually championed in his recent legislative career, you know, before he went for the presidency, was actually a federal bankruptcy law that denied people the ability to file for bankruptcy because of student debt. That basically says it all. And the reason why he supported that was because the credit card industry supported that, you know, and he, of course, like, as needless to say, had quite a long record of supporting and doing what Wall Street tells him to do. You know, he's one of those guys. And that law on bankruptcy is still on the books. You know, you cannot declare bankruptcy over student debt in the U.S. That is, you know, it's not something you can do. You're on the hook for that. You can't get away from it. So once again, like his whole, like, you know, freezing that until September, that's too little too late. That doesn't solve the problem. That's basically window dressing. I mean, you might say the same thing about Biden's cancellation of the Keystone XL pipeline. There's been a lot of fanfare about this. You know, I've seen certain activists almost reduced to tears of thankfulness over this one. And while it does open up a certain avenue, like in this country, to put pressure on Canadian politicians who continue to press for the construction of pipelines on stolen Indigenous land, it's hardly a radical decision. And you kind of see it coming, for that matter. And in many ways, it serves to mask a much deeper problem. I mean, Keystone XL was already basically dead in the water by 2021. It had been held up by judicial orders, administrative red tape, public pressure, Indigenous resistance, like very importantly, as well as the loss of prominent investors. I mean, people basically were just jumping ship. I think even the Koch brothers finally abandoned it as a dead end. And it was largely their brainchild in the first place to get, like, you know, tar sands oil all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico to their refineries, and which they would then refine in lieu of, like, Venezuelan oil, which used to be refined there, but isn't refined there now because of all the blockades and illegal sanctions that the U.S. is putting on Venezuela right now. But basically, in the past few years, I mean, virtually everybody jumped ship on that project. I mean, it just, you know, wasn't profitable. It wasn't going anywhere. I mean, Canadian tar sands oil fundamentally is a dead end. I mean, Jason Kenney and his goon squad in Alberta were about the only ones, who still holding out hope that this pipeline would go through, that it would be finished. And that the U.S. somehow wanted this dirty oil from Canada. Even though the U.S. is a net energy exporter and kind of, like, you know, produces its own oil and all kinds of natural gas and all this stuff and has no need for the tar sands. You know, right from the beginning was a long shot. You know, for these guys, and frankly, a bit of a delusion for people like Jason Kenney and, like, all that whole crowd in Alberta that, like, you know, just is totally addicted to the fossil fuels and, like, thinks that this is somehow, you know, Canada's going to be an energy superpower through the tar sands and all this stuff. It's basically fantasy from the start. You know, no one really wants to buy that stuff. But the point I really want to make here is that canceling the Keystone XL pipeline, you know, this dead-in-the-water pipeline, this was an easy move for Biden to make in order to give him environmental street cred, so to speak, you know, make him look like he's environmentally friendly. He's doing what the people want. And it's the same thing when it comes to, like, you know, rejoining the Paris Climate Accords. It doesn't actually mean that he has to do much or make greater commitments to, like, combating climate change. I mean, you'll notice that the Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, the other major pipeline project in the States, where, you know, which led to the Standing Rock protests and a massive crackdown on Indigenous land defenders. And all that happened under Obama, actually. With Biden as the vice president, that didn't get touched in this executive order. That's still going forward. And of course, the Dakota Access Pipeline was actually, like, more about frack natural gas than it was about, like, you know, tar sands and stuff like that, right? So it was actually more, that's actually where the money is. It's important to remember. Tar sands oil was never all that profitable. I mean, the Canadian government has been pouring billions of dollars into it, trying to make it profitable. It's been futile. No one wants it. And increasingly, given the way the U.S., once again, is a net energy exporter, doesn't need it, right? Doesn't need anything from Canada. Doesn't need, like, fossil fuels from Canada. Fracked natural gas, on the other hand, is very, very profitable right now. and America's been going crazy with it. And it's highly unlikely that Biden is going to move against this industry. You know, and moving against that industry is critical if America is going to do anything to cut greenhouse gases substantially over the next decades. And he's not going to move against that, and like, because that would be threatening the profits of his Wall Street backers. You know, and you know, especially when he said he was going to ban fracking during the primaries and then completely reverse his position when it came to time for the actual presidential election. Kamala Harris did the same thing, you know, originally was saying she was going to ban, push for a ban on fracking, totally reversed herself, you know, in the actual election. But of course, once again, it doesn't take much to appear environmentally conscious after Trump. You know what I mean? You know, he was the guy who pulled out of all these accords and, like, you know, didn't pretend. Didn't even pretend to, like, you know, push for any sort of, like, you know, carbon neutrality or any of that kind of stuff. You know. But that doesn't mean, like, you know, the U.S. is now headed into, like, some sort of green golden age or something like that. I mean, as I said last week, China already has 3.5 times more installed renewable energy capacity than the United States does. It also possesses the majority of the world's green transit systems, where actually the U.S. has very, very few of them, and has... And China's also made firm commitments to go carbon neutral by mid-century, which the U.S. has not done. And Biden has not made any sort of promises like towards that either, which are actually credible. I mean, a country like the United States that is addicted to fracking fossil fuels and beholden to the demands of Wall Street for short-term profitability isn't likely to make much of a dent in its carbon emissions unless revolutionary change occurs. I mean, right now, the U.S. is almost like the Saudi Arabia of fracked natural gas. It's like a colossal energy producer on the world stage. And asking them to go carbon neutral is frankly, you know, you got to do a lot more, you know, you got to go a lot further than Joe Biden. That's for damn sure. So like the common thread here, like at best what you've got with these executive orders is a long list of half measures. You know, or just like empty rhetoric at, you know, at worst. I mean, Biden just raised the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. And, you know, that's a welcome thing, but it's still a largely symbolic gesture given that there's nothing to prevent employers from cutting back on their staff or limiting the number of hours they work. Once again, this is not a law. This is an executive order, which is limited in scope. And, like, you know, there's no real safeguards attached to it and stuff, right? Now, once again, I mean, you could say, like, in Canada, I mean, you know, that maybe gives some Canadian activists leeway in terms of pushing for a greater minimum wage here. But in terms of the actual impact on the ground in the States, it's going to be quite minimal. The majority of workers will not really be affected by this change, and it certainly won't have the effect of reversing the wave of poverty that we're seeing in America today, you know, especially in the conditions of the pandemic. Nor is there anything on the in this list addressing mass incarceration or the prison industrial complex that Biden did so much to expand through his crime bill in the 1990s. I mean, are prison laborers going to get a $15 minimum wage in federal penitentiaries? I somehow doubt it. But getting into foreign policy now, one of the things Biden was hailed for reversing is the racist Trump-era travel ban on 7 Muslim-majority countries. The only problem with that is he didn't exactly reverse the December 2015 Visa Waiver Improvement and Terrorist Travel Prevention Act, you know, signed by Barack Obama, that designated Iraq, Iran, Syria, Yemen, Sudan, Libya, and Somalia, you know, all the same 7 countries that were on, like, on Trump's list as areas of concern, and heavily restricted travel to and from those countries on the basis of racially profiling Muslims as terrorists. I mean, Trump's executive order totally banning travel from those countries was based on this law. And it looks like this law isn't going anywhere. And there's no indication it's going to get scrapped, seeing it was Democrats who put it through and put it into effect in the first place. I mean, like everything on this list of executive orders, the promise kind of falls apart when you dig a little deeper. I mean, another example. Merely ending Trump's border wall won't get those kids out of those cages in the ICE concentration camps and reunite them with their families. I mean, we have to remember Joe Biden is the most powerful man in the world, effectively. I mean, he could free those kids at the snap of a finger. You know, just like he could snap his finger and cancel student debt or ensure adequate health care. You know, adopting some sort of emergency measure like during the pandemic, for example. But he won't. He's not doing that. And remember, the Obama-Biden administration was responsible for more deportations than any other U.S. administration, including Trump's. You know, more than 3 million people. You know, hundreds of thousands every year. Mostly directed at, you know, Hispanic people, brown people. So, you know, basically ending Trump's border wall is effectively a whitewash in this case. And beyond that, like, where is the firm commitment from Joe Biden to end the war in Yemen that he helped to start in 2015, supporting Saudi Arabia in destroying that country and blockading it and strangling it, right? Where is the firm commitment to end the crippling sanctions against the Syrian, Iranian, and Venezuelan peoples? Where is the commitment to pull occupying U.S. troops out of sovereign countries of like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria? Where is the commitment to end military brinkmanship with China and military provocations in the South China Sea and commit to peace? Where is the commitment for a constructive dialogue with China and Russia? I haven't seen anything. And I think, you know, all the nonsense around Russiagate, you know, a fraudulent and utterly futile attempt to bring down Donald Trump by attacking him from the right, I think that's going to seriously undermine the prospects for world peace, not to mention the utterly racist demonization of China in U.S. politics and media. You know, of course, like, you remember, like, Trump and Biden on the campaign trail, they were, like, you know, slugging each other over who's more soft on China, right? I mean, that was kind of like a big, big talking point, you know, and it's just like, you know, I'm going to be tougher on China. Oh, I'm going to be tougher on China. You know, you know, and they're talking about who's, you know, they're trying to, like, they're just like competing with each other to you know, who's going to be the toughest on China and who, like, you know, one-ups the other and saying China's like the greatest threat that America faces and all that kind of stuff, right? I mean, it's just, you know, it was an incredible spectacle, right? And we have to remember that the U.S. presidency is really the guardianship of global capitalism. You know, not just American capitalism, but the global system that it forms a hub of. I mean, the most that the guardian of the capitalist system will give to workers and the oppressed are crumbs, half measures, and empty promises. I mean, it's a masquerade. That'd probably be the best word that I could use to describe it. You know, the president wants to convince people that he's serving their interests when in fact he's there to serve Wall Street and the Fortune 500. You know, not the people. And Biden's already promised his real constituents, you know, like last year during the election, the primaries even, that nothing would fundamentally change after his election. You know, nothing would change for them. You know, he was going to back their interests, even if he, like, rolls back a few things Trump did and tweaks a few things here or there. He's going to leave things intact for them. And, you know, he is. I mean, he's leaving neoliberalism and hypercapitalism fully intact. There's no indication he's going to move away or really enact some real progressive change or meaningful reform. All he is rolling back some of the things that Trump did that the capitalist state considers superfluous. You know, he can dispense with these things because they're bad for PR. And in response, they want you to drop your guard and shut up. You know, like, here's some crumbs, shut up. You know, like, don't fall for it. I mean, this is the equivalent of giving a galley slave a little vinegar. You know, they did this back in ancient Greece and Rome. give a galley slave a little vinegar to revive him. You know, when he's about to pass out, you know, give him a little vinegar to revive him just so he can keep rowing his master's ship for a little longer. I mean, that's stimulus for you. You know, I talked about like what peanuts this like, what originally they were going to give, it was going to be $600 per person. Then they wanted to do 2000. Now they're down to 1400 and it might be whittled down even more. But any of those numbers is inadequate given the scale of the crisis. So once again, this is the capitalist stimulus, any of these kind of things which they want to put forward, basically is just trying to keep things calm. Keep things orderly. Make sure people don't go out in the streets and riot or do any of the things that we saw last summer with the BLM protests. They're afraid of that. And that's the thing that, you know, they want to put the people back to sleep, right? They make sure that there's no unrest like that. Make sure that the people don't take matters into their own hands. That's what they want to do. It's damage control, right? You know, things were definitely getting out of control. The capitalist class was getting worried at the end of Trump's reign that things were getting out of hand. You know, there was too much unrest and they want Biden to, you know, clamp down, you know, put things back under control, make sure things are orderly again. But it comes down to this. I mean, like for me, I mean, I will not apologize for this new emperor of the American Empire. You know, I will not blindly accept him as, you know, better than Trump or be thankful for the lesser of two evils. I mean, I fight for a world without emperors or empires, without exploitation and systemic oppression. I am a communist, and I do not support these blatant attempts by the new administration to whitewash a fundamentally monstrous system. You know, that was found on slavery and white supremacy and like the genocide of indigenous peoples and like, you know, just exploitation and grinding down of working people and making them work faster and harder for less and less. You know, it's the same old carrot and stick approach that the capitalist class has always used to maintain its power and hegemony over everyone else. You know, sometimes they might throw a few crumbs or make a few concessions, but in the end, they maintain their power. And they're willing to use some terrible amounts of force to secure that power. You know, I mean, after all, we saw the repression of the Black Lives Matter movement and what it experienced last year. Not just under, like, you know, from Republicans, but by Democrats as well. I mean, Democratic mayors, governors and stuff, they still sent out the riot cops to, like, you know, crack people's skulls and detain people, throw them into vans, all kinds of stuff, right? They were doing that stuff. It wasn't just like the federal government. It wasn't just the Republicans. It wasn't just Trump. The entire establishment was engaged in that crackdown. So Trump was not an anomaly or a mistake. And it's the same for the fascist movement. He's kind of like, helped to emerge like into the mainstream of American politics. I mean, he was the product of an evil system. The same system that Biden is now trying to normalize and rehabilitate in the midst of a pandemic and economic crisis brought about by the profit motive's unsustainable drive for expansion. And this is after he stole the primaries and stomped all over Bernie Sanders and his supporters, blocking any meaningful attempts at reform. You know, we can't forget that. You know, it was all kinds of like really, really shady stuff going on, like, you know, shady like apps, shady going on, the, you know, like practices in certain primaries in certain states and stuff. You know, all kinds of like really, really sketchy stuff going on back then. So, and in the end, Joe Biden promised to be an effective chief salesman for capitalism. And the last thing the world needs is another champion of neoliberalism, you know, who sells exploitation with a smile, the way Obama did. I mean, the only silver lining is that Biden is unlikely to be able to convince a majority of black people in America to support imperialist war in the way Obama did, which was basically unprecedented. You never had, before 2013, you never had more African-Americans than white people supporting military intervention in some other country. But in 2013, more black people than white people actually supported going into Syria guns blazing. You know, in response to those alleged chemical weapons attacks, right? You know, Obama actually managed to convince more black people than white people to engage in this war, you know, to, like, further expand this war that would have killed, like, hundreds of thousands of more people if they had gone in. You know, and 500,000 dead Syrians could have been, like, you know, 1 million dead Syrians or something like that. You know, like, same way, you know, you had 1 million dead Iraqis because of the invasion in 2003. You could have had a repeat of that. Fortunately, it didn't come to that in 2013, but it was still disturbing to see the fact that, you know, so many people were convinced that this was in their interest to have a wider war, like a, you know, an imperialist war, expanded imperialist war against Syria. So what I'm seeing in Joe Biden's election and replacement of Donald Trump at the head of the American empire is continuity rather than change. And speaking as a non-American, I hope that America remains mired in domestic disputes and infighting for a long time to come. You know, a strong America is not in the interests of working class and oppressed people, both internally and internationally. You know, a disunited America in disarray, a disunited American empire in disarray, means more peace for the rest of the world and more space for alternative systems to grow. That might be an unpopular opinion, but I stand by it. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR, comrades and friends. We'll be right back.
night and the owl cries as we're driving down the road. Listening to the music on the all-night radio show. And the announcer comes on, says if you've got ideas, I'll file the patent for you. What's an idea that's not in the store? Making a buck or two. Oh, we drive to the town, but the shutters are down, and the all-night restaurant's closed. It's the land of the free, they've got booze and TV. There's tramps in the telephone booth. And the early spring breeze said, forget what assassins have done. Take our good soil in the palm of your hand. Wait for tomorrow's sun. It's a long way from the heartland to Santiago Bay, where the good doctor lies with blood in his eyes. The bullets read USA. A truck driver's wife, she has a rough life. He spends his time down the road, carrying the goods, all the copper and wood. That's what makes America great. But the dollars like swallows, they fly to the south when they know they've got something to gain. Allende is killed and the trucks are soon rolling again. It's a long way from the heartland to Santiago Bay, where the good doctor lies with blood in his eyes and the bullets read USA. And the nighthawk flies and the owl cries as we're driving down the road. The full moon reveals all the houses and fields where good people do what they're told. Victor Jara, he lies with coins in his eyes. There's no one around him to mourn. Who needs a poet who won't take commands? Would rather make love than war. It's a long way from the heartland to Santiago Bay, where the good doctor lies with blood in his eyes and the bullets read U.S. of A. The bullets read U.S. of A.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was the legendary Irish singer-songwriter Christy Moore with his tribute to Salvador Allende, who of course was overthrown in a US-backed coup in 1973. And that really is a tribute to him and basically to all those who fight for justice in the face of empire. So, and of course before that we had the Handsome Furs with Serve the People. Now, I want to end the this show, this this talk about maybe the true face of this new incoming Biden administration by talking about the playing Michael Parenti's talk about the real nature of the presidency, because I mentioned before how the presidency, the American presidency, was kind of the guardianship of the capitalist system and the salesman of the global capitalist system. And this is something that Michael Parenti, in his as a progressive author and scholar, really unpacks in an effective way that I think people really need to understand at times like this. So that's what I want to kind of close out the show with here. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I will see you all next time, comrades and friends.
The authors of American government textbooks like to point out that the president plays many roles. He has many roles. He's not only chief executive, we hear, but he's also the leader of his party. He's a chief legislator in the sense that he proposes a legislative program. He's in the policy process. And he's also commander-in-chief. And he's also the head of state, the way sort of the Queen of England is, you see. He's an embodiment. When I wrote my American government textbook, Democracy for the Few, was a sort of anti-textbook, actually, I said, there's another role that he has, which none of these other books have mentioned. He's the guardian and representative of capitalism. He's the embodiment of the executive-centered state system that defends American corporate interests at home and abroad. I'm quoting from one of my favorite authors right now, as a matter of fact. Every modern president has had occasion to praise the free enterprise system and denounce collectivist alternatives. William Shannon's description of President Ford, back when William Shannon used to criticize conservatism, President Ford, it could easily apply to any number of other presidents, quote, he follows the judgment of the major international oil companies on oil problems in the same way that he amiably heeds the advice of other big businesses on the problems that interest them. He is a solid believer in the business ideology of rugged individualism, free markets, and price competition, virtues that exist more clearly in his mind than they do in the practices of the international oil industry, unquote. The president is, I maintain, the top salesman of the system. He conjures up reassuring images about the State of the Union. Nixon, America is number one. Reagan, America is standing tall. America is the greatest. This is what Ronald Reagan was saying to a nation with 35 million citizens living below the poverty level, millions unemployed, hundreds of thousands homeless, a record trade deficit, and a runaway national debt. Whether Democratic or Republican, liberal or conservative, the president tends to treat capitalist interests as synonymous with the nation's well-being. Presidents greet the accumulation of wealth as a manifestation of a healthy national economy, regardless of how that wealth is applied or distributed or what's it being used for. I mean, what's this wealth being used for? Is it being used to make more yachts? Or is it being used for housing for working people? Ronald Reagan, quote, America will achieve new heights spurred on by freedom and the profit motive. Ronald Reagan, I want America always to be a country where someone can become a millionaire. Ronald Clinton on the McNeil Lair. Quote, this is a free enterprise country, said President Clinton. I want to create more millionaires in my presidency than Bush and Quayle did. What an ambition. What a goal. He didn't say that during the campaign. During the campaign, he was Jesse Jackson. When he got into office and started setting up, he was Jimmy Carter. Now he's Ronald Reagan. Now he wants to outdo Bush and Quayle. Presidents describe the overseas investments of giant corporations as U.S. interests. Those giant interests are called U.S. interests abroad to be defended at all costs, certainly at great cost to the U.S. populace. A president's primary commitment abroad is not to democracy, but to free market capitalism. And they are beginning to say that a little more candidly. It's probably not easy for a president to remain keenly aware of the suffering and the travails and the deprivations endured by the great mass of people throughout the world, including a lot of ordinary working people in this country. I mean, the president lives like a monarch, a potentate, in utter opulence. He lives in a rent-free 132-room mansion called the White House, set on an 18-acre estate, with a personal domestic staff of about 100 people, including 7 butlers and 5 full-time florists, a well-stocked wine cellar, tennis courts, a private movie room, a private gymnasium, a private bowling alley. Lyndon Johnson must have put that one in. And a heated outdoor swimming pool. And this is a guy who's got to pose as a man of the people who's concerned about ordinary folk. In addition, the president has the free services of a private physician, including all those presidents who didn't want people to have health insurance and socialized medicine, and that would be too much and all that. They should pay for their own medical care. They all had free medical care themselves. See, it's different when you have it for yourself. You understand? It's different. That's what Norman Bradbury is pointing out. It's you out there sacrificing for the country, but I get my family out from downwind. You preach one thing out there, and you do something else. The president also has a dozen chauffeured limousines, numerous helicopters and jets, including Air Force One, and he has access to the imperial luxuries of Camp David and other country retreats, free vacations, a huge expense allowance. And then for those very few things he must pay for out of his own pocket, he gets a salary of $200,000 a year. Journalists and political scientists used to like to write, it was a real fad back in the late 50s, early 60s, used to describe the presidency as a man-killing job. Well, you know, closer investigation shows that presidents actually probably work a shorter day than the average working man or woman who really has to put in hours. That presidents take more vacations and they live far better and longer than the average American male, including the average middle-class white male. And after leaving office, by the way, they continue to feed off the public trough. 5 ex-presidents we have now, all of them multimillionaires, yet each one receives from $500,000 to $700,000 in annual pensions, office space, staff, and travel expenses, along with full-time Secret Service protection that costs $5 million for each of them. I mean, $5 million for Jerry Ford? Well, is the president too powerful or not powerful enough? Actually, I think both the liberals and conservatives are consistent in both those inconsistent charges. Presidents are not powerful enough when working with mass interests. Working for mass interests, I should say, and opposing corporate and financial interests. But the president is very powerful when engaging in the converse, when he's working for corporate interests and when he's working against mass interests. The president is very powerful when he's exercising state power. That whole theory, by the way, when liberals started talking about the imperial presidency, the Republicans hadn't gotten elected yet. There wasn't any Nixon or Ford or Reagan in yet. They were already talking about LBJ, and they were talking about Vietnam. And it occurs to them how irresponsive, unaccountable this power was, as millions of people were saying, get out of this war. And this war, these guys were still going ahead and doing it. And they're saying, my God, this president is an autocrat in a way. Well, on certain kinds of issues, and the closer he is to the state, he is. He suddenly understands that the power of that office was not imbued in the office. The power of that office was there as long as that office served powerful interests. By the way, this is true of Clinton also, what I've just said. What you have here is a structuralist argument. This is the argument of the structuralist versus the functionalist. The structuralists say that the system prefigures what the people can do who go into it. And the functionalists say, no, the people who go in can make a difference. And it's all the question of which guy's in there. Is it a good guy or a bad guy? If it's a good guy, we'll get good policy. If it's a bad guy, we'll get bad policy. The structuralist says that regardless whether it's Tory or Labor, there must still be basic concessions and provisions to those who control the jobs, investments, and market forces, who control the other levers of the state. The structuralist argument is essentially correct, but it's over-applied. Because it's one thing to say that the structure is an inescapable overriding social formation that sets fundamental limits, and it's another thing to say that the structure predetermines all policy outcomes all the time. You can't say that. You get too abstracted, too mystical. I mean, Reagan and Thatcher demonstrated that it does make a difference who's elected. So the functionalists do have a point, that within certain parameters, it does make a difference who's on the Supreme Court, who staffs the departments, who makes decisions in the regulatory agencies and in Congress. It does make a difference. It determines what laws are passed and how they're enforced or how they're ignored.
Comes the spring, and its warm thaw around your neck, the eagle claw upon your head, the buffalo horn. Today a great new chief is born, so raise him fast towards the sun. Heart now beats, a life's begun. It's 1821. Today a Blackfoot soul is born. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Your years have gone, the years have passed. Your heart is set, your soul is cast. Stand before the council fire. You have the mind and the desire of notions wise. You speak so well, and in brave deeds you do excel. And it's 1853, and you stand the chief of Confederacy. You are the leader, you are the chief. You stand against both liar and thief. They trade, raise whiskey, steal your land, and they're coming in swift like the wind-blown sand. They shoot the buffalo, kill the game, and send their preachers into shame. And it's 1864, and you think of peace, and you think of war. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. See the settler in more numbers. He takes whatever he encounters. You see the Sioux, all battered, beaten, wrong and right, they haven't eaten. And as per se, we're much the same. It seems like such a heartless game. And it's 1876, and the enemy's full of those death-dealing tricks. Today the treaty stands on the table. Will you sign it? Are you able? It offers food and protection to. Do you really think this? isn't that grand? And in return you see all of your land, and it's 1877, and you know the scales are so uneven. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Well, the buffalo are slaughtered, there's nothing to eat. The government's late again with the meat, and your people are riddled with the white man's disease. And in the summer they're sick, and in the winter they freeze. And sometimes you wonder why you signed that day, but they broke the treaties themselves anyway. And it's 1889, and your Death Star explodes, and then it falls. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. The years have gone, the years have flown, the nation's sins have swiftly grown, but yet for the Indian it's all the same. There's still hardship, there's still a pain, there's still hardship, there's still a strife. Its bitterness shines like a whetted knife. There's still hypocrisy, and the hate. Was that in the treaties? Is that the fate? We're all unhappy pawns in the government's game, and it's always the Indian gets the blame. It's a problem which money can never lessen, and it's 1967. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? There'll be a better tomorrow. Maybe one day you'll find honesty instead of the usual treachery. Perhaps one day the truth shall prevail, and the warmth of love which it doesn't take. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow.